warning.
I'm starting the recording now, too.
Okay.
So I don't forget.
Just wanted to say, as we get started, that we do have a quorum at this point. And so our tradition is for Joy and others is that we start right at 4 o'clock. So there may be some others that will probably pop in the last minute, but just wanted us to be aware. Oh, we're getting more folks coming in. So 4 o'clock is the time. So I'm going to start in just 1 minute. So Kathy, howdy. All right.
So welcome to Commissioner Kelly.
Yes.
Woo-hoo!
Commissioner
Kelly. Hey, to everybody. Honored to be here. Thank you.
Woohoo!
Hey, Dina. Hi, Joy. Welcome, everybody. Yay! Okay, let me get myself fixed.
All right, we're looking good. We may gather another person or two along the way, but at 4 o'clock, I'm going to go ahead and open the September meeting of the Ashland Housing Human Service Commission and welcome our two new commissioners, Kathy Kelly and Joy Fate. Everybody give a big wave to them. I would just say on Tuesday night at the city council meeting, they were both approved unanimously, I guess, with consent agenda. And also unanimously, the city council approved our recommendations for the human services awards that we made for 11 groups. And I think that may be the first time that we've had those approved unanimously all in one time. So that was a good
great
stand.
Job. Great job, Rich and Linda, both of you. Great job. Thank you.
Well, everybody, we did such good work on that, in my opinion, and apparently others, that it did go through well. And I think that is indicative of the kind of relationship that we're building on the council level. And certainly Gina helps with that process. So our next thing would be on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. So as the packet went out with the minutes and an opportunity to review them, and both Linda Rapond and Heidi are not here, and Heidi's our detail-oriented person that goes through them.
So I'm going to leave it up to Jackie.
Jackie's got an approval now. Okay, go ahead.
I read them, and I move to approve the minutes.
Oh, nice. Wow. Second.
Okay.
Chris, is your name spelled right?
Okay.
Okay.
Let's practice our voting. So all in favor of approving the minutes as presented, give us a wave. Kathy, and you guys are open to voting if you want.
I'll abstain for this particular one.
Okay, we got two abstentions and the rest approval. So the minutes are approved. So the next thing on the agenda is the public forum. And Linda, do you have people? I thought there were some people that might be signing up for that.
I don't know if anyone has signed up, but I do have four people who are in attendance that we can't see or hear. So I do want to let people who are attendees at this time know that if you do have a comment, or if you want to make a comment, either on just the public forum piece or later on the public hearing for the Community Development Block Grant Consolidated Annual Performance Evaluation Report. Sorry, that's a mouthful. Please put it in the chat or raise your hand, and I believe I can see those things. And then I can promote you to a panelist, which is, you know, where your screen's going to go dark for just a minute, but then you're just going to come in and we'll be able to see and hear you. So I do want to let people know that. I guess it's sort of Zoom housekeeping.
With no public forum, people, we just picked up 5 minutes, but use them wisely. Our next piece on the agenda is the Housing Now! Proposal presentation from Eric Navickas. And so we've seen a little bit about what he's presented, but he's going to give us a presentation for 10 minutes and an option or an ability to ask a lot of questions in that process. So Eric, do you have a piece that you want to share online, or do you want to just speak to it?
Oh, I was just going to speak to it. Can everyone hear me? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, great. And I'm also with Chris Kendrick. He's also here, and we're both going to be presenting together. So I assume you've seen the packet items that I put forward. And we are Housing Now, so we're just a grassroots organization of citizens in the community who have formed together to begin to address the housing crises that we have for a breadth of different housing. We are looking currently at the Hargadine parking structure because we are looking at the possibility of developing that for housing above. And that was a proposal that was brought forward back in 2003, but was never realized. And at that point, the council was really looking at the possibility of developing a variety of different surface parking lots that the city owns in the downtown. And unfortunately, that also has never been realized and has been kind of put on the back burner. And we're really working to try to bring that back forward, especially considering the current crisis that's been exacerbated by the Alameda fire. And what we really see as a lack right now is entry-level workforce housing. It's reached a point to where our downtown businesses are having problems finding people to fill the jobs because there aren't people living in the downtown, and the cost of commuting has become so excessive, it's difficult to fill those jobs. So we really need that type of entry-level housing. I'm sure the commission is very well aware of this too. So we are looking especially at the downtown C1D zone in this case because of that reason, but also because it doesn't require parking. And our ideal is also very oriented towards environmental sustainability, where people can live and work in the downtown. I mean, you might consider developing a very green development outside of town, but the footprint becomes so large because people are commuting. But if we can develop in that downtown where people can live and work and walk, do their shopping, you're going to have a much more long-term green development. We have been consulting with a local developer, Bob Kendrick, and we're also working with Mark Knox. And we feel like we have a team together that can really move forward fairly quickly and get housing on the ground. But at this point, we are just working to initiate a conversation around this with the council. And that's why we wanted to come to the Housing Commission to apprise you of what we're doing and possibly get your support as well. And why don't I hand it over to Chris, and he can talk quickly about what we're looking at as far as developing this around a community land trust and a limited equity cooperative.
Can you hear me?
It's fine.
Am I coming through? Oh, great. Yeah, thanks for having me today. Like Eric said, I'm with Ashland Housing Now, and we've had that parking garage in our radar for a while because it's just such a great piece of land downtown and can really present the city with an opportunity to create some permanent affordable housing downtown. We've been doing a bit of research, and we've kind of come to the conclusion that the best form of housing for to create permanent affordable housing in Ashland would be through a community land trust, partnering up with permanent housing on top that would come in the form of limited equity cooperative housing. You know, we've been talking with community land trust, you know, throughout the country. It's a pretty sustainable model. It's been around for a good 60 years. And what it does, it really ensures that the housing is going to remain affordable in perpetuity with what we're hoping is a 99-year lease that the city can, you know, hand over to the community land trust and, you know, through some assistance, you know, we can bring down the price of the living situation there and actually create housing that is not just renting, not just housing that you rent, but housing that people actually own. So They'll take pride in their place and have a sense of ownership. But beyond that, they'll have an opportunity to make decisions collectively, if it's in the form of a cooperative. This will assist in bringing down costs around management and also partnering up with, you know, the local neighborhood. That's like essential at the community land trust, is that you're working with the neighborhood, with experts, and with the people that are maintaining the lease with the city, which is the community land trust. We've been looking into forming our group into becoming a nonprofit so that we could set up this community land trust with the city. However, I mean, there's other groups out there that might be able to step in. As I understand, there's a group talking today, which is Proud Ground, and they have a lot of experience in this. And, you know, maybe it's somebody that can help out with it, or somebody we can partner up with. Just a lot of options. And I just think this would be a great opportunity for the city to just create a legacy for permanent affordable housing in the city of Ashland. I'll just pass it over to Eric now.
Yeah, and I laid out some, what we are asking the city is to offer assistance in financing the project. And we have listed various options that the city has right now. And a lot of what drove us to begin to look at this was because of the fact that the city is looking at selling quite a bit of city property. And we want to be assured that those funds go back into investments, that they aren't squandered through the operational side of the budget, but go back into capital improvements. And with the need of housing so dire at this point, we're hoping that we can really push the council to invest that money back into housing. And they have, as they sell these properties off, I mean, they're all, none of them are sold yet, but they have about $3.5 million worth of housing, of property that they're looking at selling right now. So if they were to consolidate that could be a substantial amount of money to look at it. And then we have some other funding options, looking again at the CDBG funds, and possibly consolidating those out for 5 years through borrowing against them with a revenue bond. And then also the housing trust fund, which possibly could also be borrowed against with a revenue bond. Revenue bonds don't require going out to the voters. They're simply based on guaranteed revenue. And then, of course, other federal or state grant money. But really, right now, what we're looking from the council is that we are given an opportunity to begin a conversation with them, and that they direct their city staff to begin to investigate funding options and to meet with us about moving forward with the development, and allow us to submit planning documents to the planning department. So that's the gist of it. And I'd like to open it up to questions and hear what your thoughts are.
Okay, I've got a whole bunch, but let's stop and let folks on the commission and others start with some questions. There's got to be a lot. So Jackie, go ahead.
I really applaud this concept of looking at city property and trying to find a way to get more housing in Ashland. So I think that's a great idea. The concern I have is where those properties are located and what's going on around them. So my first question, I have many also, but my first question is, has there been any discussion with, for instance, the neighbors to that area? And I'm talking about, for instance, Cabaret and OSF. And of course, there are many businesses around that area. Is there any ongoing discussion, hearing from them what their concerns might be?
Yeah, actually, I met with Ted DeLong with OSF on Monday via Zoom, of course. But he was very excited about the prospect of the idea, and actually talked about possibly even partnering with us. But, you know, all of that has to be figured out. But they do have some capital available possibly for housing. They do have a union agreement with their union that requires them to house their employees within a half a mile of the bricks. So they were very supportive, which was really good to hear. And that, you know, this was developed at the time with the intent of building up the foundations and footings. And we have checked with the engineer about building up. And it was built initially for two more decks of cars. So housing could easily be built. And it was intended at the time, the council made motions to build to reserve the airspace for affordable housing. I also am organizing a meeting with the hotel ownership, the Newman Group, and sometime next week, probably I'll meet with them. You know, we are looking at real workforce housing. This isn't like transitional housing, though. We are looking at lower income brackets is really our goal, because we want to provide housing for that real entry level workforce. But, you know, we're not talking about a homeless shelter here or anything like that. We are talking about workforce housing.
Gina, go ahead. You're under Linda Reed, but go ahead, Gina.
We're so interchangeable, Linda and I, so it's okay. So, Eric and Chris, thank you so much. And a great question, Jackie. Something that I wanted to say is I am going to set up an appointment with Newman Hotel Group for Eric to meet with them. I just met with Don Anway, the COO of Newman Hotel Group, and I told him and Eric it was accepted well. The first thing that flew out of his mouth was, what about parking? And I said, what about parking? People will be able to get on the bus or walk to their job, you know? So, and that was the only question about that. So that was very positive. And I look forward when you hear from the other people, other business owners in that area, how that's going to look, and the people behind the parking garage, because it's kind of their view. At one point, Doug and Becky Newman were going to build up in the parking lot behind Ashland Springs Hotel. And the big pushback there was the people behind them. They didn't want to lose the view. So I just wanted to put that out there, but I'm very excited about this. And Councilor Graham and myself have put it on the look ahead for the city council meeting. It will be there October 19th. And I look forward to that presentation.
Thank you. Other questions? Well, I'll throw in a comment and a question. One is that within our commission's goals for this year was workforce housing. And it's a difficult one to address. It's, as you know, housing that's affordable to the people who work there. But it's also a kind of, it's not as well defined as it might be. And so I think as you move forward, I guess my suggestion is to start as you move forward with the economic analysis of it, is to look at what is the exact kind of income levels that you can attach to the program. As opposed, we're all going to support workforce housing, but that's one. And then the other question, or I assume that as of now, the land trust that you would work with is not yet decided. And I guess I just hope that along the way, I think having that land trust on board earlier rather than later, I don't know, it seems to me to be a good strategy, that they might also be able to provide information to the council and to y'all about the best practices for land trust work. So others echo, anybody have other questions? Chris?
Yeah, yes, maybe Linda Reed could probably jump in. If for whatever reason, if we're not able to, let's say, sell the properties, you know, CDBG was mentioned and the trust fund also, do we, like, can you give us some insight? Is that something that we can actually use towards this to help finance that part of it?
Oh, as far as the property sales, the council has moved most of those properties that are listed. The council has already moved to direct staff to sell those properties. I know that there were a motion, I'm on several of them, that was directed towards staff that that should be used for affordable housing. So there is some debt tied to some of those properties and things like that that might preclude using the entire amount, but that money is available and it should be used for affordable housing. And, you know, it shouldn't be squandered on tax cuts, because that just goes in the operational side. It would be like selling your house to pay for your groceries or something like that. We want to see it reinvested in more capital improvements.
And I can add to that, Chris. CDBG funding would be this type of activity would be an eligible use of CDBG funding. It's a capital improvement. It could be used to pay the lease cost, though I think Eric and Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, that you are hoping to get no lease fee. or if there is a lease fee, CDBG can be used for that. Affordable Housing Trust Fund can also be used for that. But both of those funds are actually sort of their highest priority is for the development of affordable housing types, including workforce housing, either rental or ownership.
Great. Linda, Gina, go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know what? I just wanted to say something quickly. When Eric, you talked about that land that the city has, it was asked to look into the sale of that property, but just in my experience, my short term on city council, it would be more expedient and move quicker going through the CDBG and the land trust than to wait for the city to sell these properties. So I think that maybe if you do everything and ask for everything, because the CDBG and the land trust, I feel very strongly would happen quicker than the sale of the properties that the city owns. And I hear you, I agree with you, but I don't feel like they would sell that quick.
Yeah, and again, this is all preliminary. What we really are asking is that the city staff investigate funding mechanisms to fund this project. And I think all these things are on the table, including the sale of the property, as well as the CDBG funds and the housing trust fund. And there may be other grants available, especially if Biden is successful in pushing forward his budget agenda. So, you know, likely we'll see a lot of money committed to infrastructure building of housing and getting process rolling at this point is really what we want to move forward with.
Other questions? Echo.
I just want to echo the call. Sorry, I can't help it. The call for a land trust. We used to have one, as I'm sure Eric will remember, because you're an old timer. And then it kind of got dismantled, and that history is, you know, I understand a little bit of it, but a lot of it's opaque to me. So it's really about reviving something that used to exist, but in somewhat new form. So it's not like we haven't done it before. We let it go for whatever reason, the city let it go. And so I'd like to see it come back. I'd like to put, the revival of a land trust into the goals for the Housing and Human Service Commission next time we do goal setting. And I also think it'd be an opportunity for us to allow people in Ashland who have estates that they want to give to worthy causes a chance for people to donate to funds from their estates to a land trust. And I believe that's something that at the moment is almost impossible for people to do. So those are my comments.
Thank you. Jackie, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that was mentioned was using CDBG or Ashland Trust Fund over 5 years to pay for debt or whatever. So my concern there is just the balance of if you tie up those funds for 5 years, then how does that affect things like social service grants or other projects like Columbia Project coming into our community? So there's this balance of funding that gets affected that I just think we need to think about. Is that right, Linda? Am I thinking that through right?
Absolutely. Yes, you are, Jackie. If we bond 5 years worth of our CDBG, we don't actually have a mechanism at this point for bonding affordable housing trust funds, though I think that that is probably, could be a council decision in the way that is structured, and it would be similar to CDBG. The process for bonding your five-year CDBG allocation is called a Section 108 loan, and it's a program that you apply for through HUD, and then, yes, you take that 5 years worth of allocation, and you put it all toward one project, and then you don't get an allocation for 5 years. So we wouldn't go through our normal process, and we wouldn't offer that funding to social service organizations.
Yeah, the good thing about consolidating it, and I understand your concern, definitely. But right now, with the federal restrictions around the CDBG funds, they aren't that competitive because the additional costs of taking those funds are offset the benefits of them. So if you can get a larger sum of money, that becomes less significant. So if you can consolidate it over 5 years and get the $1 million, then your additional costs your additional costs will be flat, but you'll get additional money to back it up. So it's really beneficial to consolidate those funds. Would you agree with that, Linda?
Yes, CDBG funding is difficult to move, especially for capital projects, as we have seen in the past. The added costs due to Davis-Bacon wage rates, environmental review processes, the time frame it takes to get through all of that can add so much cost to a project that grantees are not willing to expend the time and the extra funding. So we have struggled with that in the past, and that's why we have a hard time getting rid of our capital funds. Social service or public service portion of the CDBG grant allocation is only 15%. And so it is a limited resource for those social service or public service types of activities. And many communities do bond their funding so that they can do larger projects.
Well, I think we're just about at the end of our time that we scheduled for this. If there aren't more questions, I would like to just kind of summarize for Eric and the from our commission. It sounded like you had strong support in terms of interest in pursuing forward. So if that helps you in the next step, doesn't say like we've approved anything, but there's really a strong interest on the commission to see this project succeed. So and Gina and others will be, and you all will be taking that forward at the council level, but we'll be ready. Linda.
So Jessica Aravello is here. And Jessica, I don't know if you wanted to touch base with Chris and Eric, as you are a representative of Proud Ground, who will also be presenting today. But I just wanted to allow you some space for that if that was something you wanted to do.
Yeah, right before we started, I did see an email from Eric, and so it would be good to connect.
Excellent. Yeah, that was another member of our group actually that emailed you, but that's all right. But it'd be great to get together and learn what your organization is doing, and if we could dovetail this together with your organization or whatever, that could work really well. But we'll get in touch with you and really appreciate it.
Excellent.
And yeah. And thanks so much, Rich, for, and everyone for giving us your time and offering support as well. Hopefully we can make this happen and begin to address some of the housing shortages that we have in our community. And did you want to add anything, Chris?
No. Thanks for having us today.
Oh, I think we all appreciate getting in on the start of an exciting project. So I know we'll be back in touch down the way as it goes forward, but thank you all for making that presentation and for getting us started on a nice new journey. So the next thing on the agenda is SOU Properties presentation. We have Greg Perkins and Susan Dysgaard. But Chris, did you want to introduce it, or who's going to take the lead on this next presentation?
Sure, I think I can probably introduce it, since this was kind of my brainchild storm idea here. So there's been a lot of discussion, of course, around SLU properties, in entertaining the idea of what's going to happen. And then, of course, bringing other groups into this this presentation as well. So we got other partners, Proud Ground, as you saw, Habitat for Humanity as well. So really, I just want to just kind of see where we're at with SOU, and we'll kind of move forward in some of the other discussions we're having tonight, and some, you know, just entertain ideas that we have. But, you know, land trust has always been a real big thing, and we're hearing more about that now. So again, I just want to kind of bring everybody to the table and maybe have a good discussion on what's going to happen and looking at some possibilities. So Greg, I'll let you take it away.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation. So I'm Greg Perkinson. I'm the Vice President for Finance and Administration at SOU. Susan Dysgaard is actually my executive assistant. She helped coordinate my being here. Gene Stallman is on the panel with me, and I think Gene's going to help by monitoring the chat as I step through the charts. What I'd like to do is a really quick intro, then share my screen, show some charts, and then hopefully that'll facilitate any dialogue or questions that you may have. Sound okay? All right, perfect. Thanks. So here's the introductory piece. Affordable housing is a key issue for us as well. It's a key issue for our staff. It's a key issue for our students. And so we share your interest and concern in that. And of course, we balance that with the execution or the prosecution of our primary mission, which is education. So on that note, I'm going to share my screen. I will also note that last September with the Alameda fire, it really heightened our focus and awareness on the immediacy of the need as we explored a lot of different options on how to take care of our people. So I would just note that. And so I am going to see if I can share my screen effectively here. This is always an opportunity.
It should be all set up to allow you to do that.
Perfect. It looks like it's working. Okay, I got a thumbs up. So I've been told by Jean and her discussion with others that some of you have seen the webinar that we had on the 2nd of June. And so thank you for taking a look at that. And oh, by the way, I skipped the thank you for inviting us, because I appreciate being here and I appreciate what you do. Your service matters. And so I appreciate that. So with the webinar on the 2nd of June, I want to give it a little context. And just briefly, what I want to suggest or share with you is that Dr. Schott established a task force looking at financial sustainability overall. As we studied that, she charged a smaller group to look at excess properties and to give her recommendations on the highest and best use of that. Of those lands. And so the charts I'm going to step through here will really, it'll be two charts that we showed our board of trustees on the 18th of June. So you'll see what we recommended to the board. And then it's a couple of charts that are an abbreviated version of the slide deck that we used on the webinar. And again, we can provide a link to the webinar, and you can see it in its entirety, but that abbreviated version will hopefully give you a sense for what we're looking at there. Okay, so this is the first of the two charts that we showed our board, and it really highlights the dual purpose of that properties task force. The first is all about mission, and shoring up our financial health directly supports the mission. And the second piece is all about, you know, trying to find creative ways to support the housing shortage. This chart indicates what those recommendations to the board were, and the board accepted these recommendations. And so in a nutshell, you can see the first is all about the sale of those properties that were pretty clearly in the just go do it category. My words, not the board's. And then secondarily, and I would highlight the third note as you read this chart, the third bullet point really talks about the potential for public-private partnerships. And we see a couple of opportunities there. The biggest target for me would be that that property at the corner of Ashland and Walker Street. And in some of the charts that follow, I'll be able to highlight that particular parcel. Okay, so here's the a couple of three charts that are the excerpt from the webinar. The first chart here gives you a broad brush overview of those, you know, roughly 30 plus properties that we asked the task force to study. The color coding that you'll see on the charts that follow have some meaning. So, for example, red is representative of the task force suggesting that those be sold as single family residential properties, the purple being multifamily, the blue being properties that could be or should be retained from multifamily, green represented retained in support of our primary mission, and then gray being those things that could be a public-private partnership opportunity. So here you see some purple and some green. So green being to retain. Just as a quick reference frame, this is the Mountain Avenue Henry Street intersection. Siskiyou Boulevard is to the top of the page and off the page, and the campus is to the right. So these charts will just give you a little closer look at some of these different areas.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
When you say retain properties, that's just meaning that you're retaining them for other uses or?
Retaining them, not selling them.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for the question. So this is the first section, if you will. Here's a highlight of the Elkader-Roca Street intersection where you can see the recommendation was to retain the president's residence. That's in green. The other four properties are identified for sale. Here you can see an interesting intersection where Cascade Hall is. So some of you may be familiar with Cascade Hall. We actually studied it as part of our potential options and alternatives to respond to the Almeda fire for temporary housing. But you can see some properties recommended for sale across the street from Cascades. We did receive $3.5 million from the state in the last legislative session to demolish Cascades, which is awesome because it provides a greenfield opportunity for us, and it also reduces operating costs. So I'm a fan of both. And let's see, here we go. So there were a lot of pictures in the webinar of homes that were listed. Again, I didn't highlight all 31 of the properties in this very quick overview, but just wanted to give you a sense for the type of information that was shown. What this picture amplifies or represents is that some of these homes are in pretty bad shape. Now, this is more than just a paint job, by the way. So, and some of these unfortunately have differential settlement on foundations, water damage, fire damage. The list is long, unfortunately. And what's also unfortunate is that in the last 5 or 6 years, we've had what I would characterize as a lack of appropriate state funding to support our general education. And as a result, we've had to shore up financial capability to the core mission, which gave us less capability to do what we might have wanted to do to restore or repair some of these single family homes. So I recognize I'm not coming to you with any great solutions with this presentation, but I wanted to give you, as Chris indicated, just a status update at a high level on what President Schott discussed at the webinar, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. I just wanted to, I'm glad we have an opportunity here. Are there folks so far that have questions about what we've seen? I mean, there was actually in a short time, there was a lot of information in there. I just wanted to see if. Okay, Linda, go ahead. And then Jackie.
I guess my quick question, Greg, would be about the single family homes, just as I see those, without actually having seen them, I should say, as sort of low hanging fruit for redevelopment, whether that is picking up those homes and moving them to a different location, as Rich probably remembers has been done before in the past, and then rehabilitating those and selling those to low income homeowners through a land trust model, which is a thing that has happened here in Ashland in the past, or whether those homes you expect them think that they may be available for just repair on site and resell, or whether you think they need to be completely raised and just have something new developed in their place.
It's a great question, and I think the answer varies depending on which property we're looking at. For example, the specific recommendation related to the three houses on Walker Street that are close to the intersection with Ashland, they're in really rough shape. And the task force's recommendation is to raise those. And the thought was selling the land and would provide liquidity that would help us with other potential development opportunities. So that's an example of houses that are in really tough shape. The corner of Henry and Mountain, there are about five structures there. One's got an 8-inch differential settlement in the foundation. That house is thrashed. Technical term, sorry. The other one was on had a fire in it years ago. The other one had water damage. They're in really rough shape. So I would bulldoze those three houses if it was me. So really, the task force's recommendation on those single family homes was sell them. And then what the developer, or I should say what the buyer chooses to do, ends up being their call. And so I think it does get nuanced. Does that help, Linda?
Yes, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Jackie, go ahead.
So I don't understand all of it, but I've always wondered, I've only been here about 7 years in Ashland, but I've always wondered about student housing and dorms and having enough dorm space. And then if we're not going, and then I've seen dorms that are vacant and I've heard that they are structurally damaged. So I'm thinking, is there some way to allow those dorms to be rehabilitated and they could be workforce housing? Or I keep looking for some opportunity there. Can you help me with that?
I can. I'll try to unpack that like dorm by dorm, because I think the cases matter. So Cascades, for example, which we just got funded to raise or to demolish, those are in bad shape. 1950s, 60s vintage. They're really tired. So thankfully the state gave us $3.5 million to demolish those. And then that gives us opportunity. Green Springs is the next area I would highlight. There are four towers. That's right on the corner of Whiteman and Siskiyou. And unfortunately with the Green Springs, it's an older layout. It's the traditional community style bathroom. We had some displaced folks from the fire in there temporarily. but the communal bath arrangement and the style is out of, let me say, currency or out of vogue compared to the new dorms that are right opposite to it, Shasta and McLaughlin, that I'll get to in just a moment. So with Green Springs, one of the towers is down for mechanical problems where the mechanical pipes have just corroded and eroded. And so it's down for mechanical reasons, which really effectively means there's no heat in one tower. The other tower is on its last leg, which only gives us 2 out of the 4. So we have some flexibility with those, but it's minimal. The newest dorms, Shasta and McLaughlin, are part of a public-private partnership. So we, back in 2012-13-ish, we partnered with a Collegiate Housing Foundation and probably $45 million bond-ish to construct those, plus the dining facility. And that represents a great capability for our students. We have a first fill requirement. And so what we have is a contract with that private entity. We fill those to 95%. We operate and manage the dorms. And then we receive a ground lease payment in return that we can then either keep within the housing auxiliary or transfer a portion of back to the education and general fund. That may be a little too much detail. Those dorms are in great shape. To give a high level number, it's about 1,000 bed spaces for students. That's a pretty good, that's feels pretty good. Now we also have student and family housing, which is down Whiteman, or up Whiteman, I guess, depending on how you wanted to, toward Maine. So we have a number of student and family housing units that are available, and we have a consistent wait list for those, which would be representative of the need for affordable housing. So we really have an appetite to develop affordable housing options for students and staff. Dorms, probably about the right size. Other units we could do more with. I skip Madrone. We have another upper class dorm called Madrone, but it's in pretty good shape. Please, Gina.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. And Jackie kind of asked my question, and I appreciate that. But something I was thinking that I heard you say, demolish Cascade, and this is a good thing. And then it has opportunities. What opportunities are you talking about? And with the shortage, are you talking about opportunities to rebuild, opportunities to take that money and go somewhere else with it? What are you, because I don't know if I have been in Cascade, I've seen that. And so I know that it's really on its last leg, but we're back at the place with not enough housing for our students. So when you say demolish it and it's a great possibility, what do you mean by that?
I'll use an example of the when the Alameda fire came through, we had a lot of different groups walk Cascades with us, brainstorming potential opportunities in the short term. So for example, Pam Marsh, John Fields, and many others. I think we had representatives from Access, a regional housing authority with the state. We had all kinds of folks walking through, city planners. And we were looking at the potential to use it in the short term. And what we found, aside from a near-term issue with the lack of a heat exchanger to convert steam to heat, that's only about $70,000, you know, that's manageable. Life safety code issues, you know, no fire suppression, accessibility, ADA challenges, and then the communal configuration, especially during a pandemic, really challenged our, so we had a willingness, but not a capability to, and then really no resources to make the improvements that would let people move into the space. So it was an opportunity, but so I use that as like a near-term study. We actually had the Corps of Engineers, the Army Corps of Engineers emergency branch came down and they did a walkthrough and they had some grand ideas. Oh yeah, we could do what we did after Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey and throw money at it. And we're like, cool, throw money at it. But that didn't follow. So let me answer the development side of that. There are two central ideas I've heard. I like both. One would be to partner with a private entity to build retirement housing. It's close to Ali. That could be a nice fit. Maybe there's a connection between the SOU students and retirees. So that was kind of an interesting idea. The other one is create a conference capability. During the summer, we have a lot of sports camps, middle school age, you know, camps of different sizes and flavors, and we're going to lose our conference housing when Aspen, Baker, and Cedar, there's three wings of Cascades, that when we demolish those, we're going to lose our conference capability. So I would love to replicate that, but we're going to have to find somebody with the resources to help with that.
Can I say we're kind of on a few minute timeline, but let me see. I saw Gina had a question and Echo had a question. Go ahead. Gina,
well, go ahead. I'll just wrap up by saying thank you, Greg, for that information. But my concerns still lie with where the student's going to live. You know, I appreciate the retirement. I appreciate, you know, having this convention place in the place to house you. Working for Newman Hotel Group, I say send them down the street to Ashland Hills, let them stay there. But it just goes back to the housing for the students. So that's kind of where I am. And that's what I'm looking to try to see how we can get to that. Yes. So I'll pass it on to Echo. I don't want to hog the time, but thank you.
Okay, Greg. You're welcome.
And I'll just follow up on what Gina talked about. I seem to remember that there's usually a long waiting list for student family housing. Is that still correct, Greg?
It is.
If redeveloping that ground that Cascade sits on for students with families would seem to be a particularly good fit. Or for lower income seniors. I mean, not $500,000 condominiums. Please don't do that.
Right.
And certainly not with those single family lots that will get sold. That would be a really bad look for the university to do that, even though private developers might want to do that. But having, three and maybe even a few 4-bedroom units for our students who are non-traditional, older students, with families who sometimes are also doing elder care for older members of their families, not only for children. When we see SOU students, I think sometimes people not connected to SOU don't understand that the average age of an SOU student is around 27 years old. And I certainly have had students at age 60 in my experience. So it's a whole range of folks. And most of them are really low income folks. They're on food stamps. They're getting other kinds of government subsidies. They have erratic health care insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So having more student family housing that meets those students' needs is what would make me most happy in both parts of my brain, both the Housing Commission and my SOU brain.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
We have benefit from both of those parts, Echo. let me say, I think if we don't have other questions, I'm going to thank Greg and Chris for helping facilitate this conversation. I mean, it's one of the first that I think we've had in some time with the Housing Commission and SOU. And I think what I got out of it, and maybe others, is that there's still a lot of potential out there. And I think for the Housing Commission, it means as we go into our end of the year goal setting and kind of readjusting our goals for the coming year, we can kind of consider this, because it doesn't look like it's something right now that is immediate that we exactly have to operate on, but we do have an established connection now that would help that a lot. So thank you for being here. Thank you for that presentation. And Linda wants to say, or were you waving, or you were waving? Okay. So thank you. And
you're welcome.
The next thing we have, Proud Ground Land Trust. And Yasika, I see you there. Is there other people that are going to be part of that presentation, or are we going to turn it over to you?
Good afternoon, everyone. Just me.
Okay.
But unfortunately, I have another presentation to get to by five. I have 20 people registered for an information session, so I have to hop off. And so I just, very briefly, maybe we can reschedule so that I can present to you guys next time and, get into a more of a conversation in answering any questions that you guys might also have. But I don't want to just leave like that. So do you guys have any questions that maybe I can answer like within the next couple of minutes before I have to go?
Well, can you just outline kind of the gist of your organization? I know some about it, but if you could just kind of share with people kind of what you're doing and where there's some possibilities of connecting.
Great. Yeah. So Proud Ground, as you know, is a community land trust, and we're also a nonprofit. We have been established for the past 22 years. We were established by the city of Portland back in 1999. In this time, we have been able to assist over 425 households to be able to get into permanently affordable homeownership opportunities. And we basically have utilized the model in different ways. And so there's three main ways to be able to purchase within the program. One of them is utilizing buyer-initiated grants, where the cities and the counties give us funding. And then we pair up that funding with our families that are low to moderate income and qualify for the program. And then from there, they basically obtain a mortgage. So for instance, let's say that the city gives us grant funding for let's say $100,000. And so then on top of that $100,000, we have the family obtain a mortgage with one of our approved lenders. The mortgages that they obtain are conventional mortgages with fixed interest rates and great low interest rates, because we utilize the Oregon Bond Loan Program. And so then they obtain the loan. Let's say that we ask them to get a loan for, right now the housing market is very crazy. And so we're asking more and more that folks qualify for at least $300,000. And then on top of that $300,000, we're giving them the $100,000 that the city or the counties are giving us, so that combined, they're able to buy a house that's worth $400,000 in the open market. The other ways to be able to purchase is basically we have done some acquisition and rehab. And so the cities have been able to identify properties that need repair. That need to be brought up to code, or sometimes that need to be demolished and built new again. And so from there, we have worked with other developers. We are developers ourselves, but we mainly partner with Habitat for Humanity and other community development agencies that are able to bring that expertise. The other way to purchase is basically resale properties that we have. And so the resales are really a testament of how the community land trust truly does work. So for instance, as I mentioned, the median home price right now in the area, it's about $400,000. But a lot of the resales that we're having right now tend to be anywhere between $100,000 and up to $200,000, $240,000. And so that is a huge difference for folks that are low to moderate income. And again, it just speaks to how the community land trust does work in creating that permanent affordability and making sure that there are opportunities available for moderate to low income families in the future.
Can I ask a quick question, Yasika?
Yes.
Gosh, did I pronounce your name right?
Is it close? Yasika. Yasika.
I'd rather get it right. Sorry about that. So are you saying that it, under the first option, is pairing the funding with the homeowner? Are you saying that they would need to pre-qualify for a 300 plus thousand loan?
Yeah, so basically what we do is that once we know how much funding either the cities or the counties are going to give us, at that point, we do a market analysis to be able to estimate what is the median home price in the area that we're going to have funding in. And then based off of that, that's how we determine how much of a loan the family or the household is going to have to provide on top of the mortgage assistance that we're going to provide to them.
So what does something like bottom line after everything is said and done, how much debt will that low income household be responsible for?
Well, like I said, it varies quite a bit. And so right now, our opportunities tend to vary anywhere between 170,000 for the resales. And for the newer opportunities, it's looking more like 300, 350 in some areas. And so in the lower end, in the 170,000, that mortgage payment tends to be around anywhere between 950 and up to $1,000. And then in the upper end, it's more like 1800.
Right.
Yeah. But the interest rates are still excellent and really low, which is a great benefit at the moment.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for answering my question.
Yeah. But like I said, I'll be happy to come back and give a full presentation. I'm sorry that I have to go so fast. And
thank you for being here. And we will probably take you up on the reschedule.
Yeah.
Before the end of the year, because that's when we're going to be making some decisions. But let me just be clear.
Yeah, and please let me know, like, if you guys have any specific questions too. Oh. We haven't spoke in combination with Habitat for Humanity, and so doing some partnerships around just what could be possible and what are some of the things that we can bring to the table to assist you.
And so, in conclusion, you're able to work in Southern Oregon.
Yes.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you, Yasika. And we'll be back in touch. That sounds terrific.
Excellent. So, you guys have a good evening. And I'm sorry I have to go.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
So, Rich, I might suggest, and I mean, just to the group, and you guys obviously can decide whether this sounds like something you'd. But you know how that goes.
I do.
So maybe we should have Yasika come to the goal setting so that we can have a lot of time with her and to learn more about her programs. And so I have to say, we don't have anything this right now, or not, I wouldn't say we don't have anything. We don't, our October meeting is not full, but we will need to talk at our October meeting about planning for the November meeting. I have to get details on that, but it is our rent burden meeting that we are required to do for the state before the end of the year. And so we wouldn't really have, we could have her on that meeting, the October meeting, or we could have maybe an extended period of time with her at the
December meeting. Well, just a show of hands quickly, how many would like to invite her for the December goal planning meeting that you suggested?
Sure.
Anybody? It sounds like that probably the best shot that we would have if we could do that.
And I would, just for the newer members, the goal setting retreat is usually, what is it, like a 4-hour long meeting? But it is the meeting where we get to have a more time with a provider to learn more about their programs, to have a more casual question and answer session, and then have time to do our goal setting as well. So it's usually a longer meeting with, it's more casual. We don't actually take minutes because we aren't doing any action, but it's a good opportunity for education.
And when we could do it in person, it was really cool. I guess we'll have to Zoom it this time.
Yeah.
But it'll still be good. Do we have someone from Habitat for the next thing?
So yes, Denise was here and she seems to have fallen out of the meeting. And I sometimes wonder if that is an accident. So I am not seeing her in the attendee list, and I'm not seeing her in the panelist list. And I did check my email as well to see if maybe something happened, but I don't have any.
Let's just go to the severe climate event discussion. But if you could see if you can pull her back on, because I think her presentation fits right in the middle of all the things that we're doing. And so it would be good if she is available. So as we all know, the council asked us to address severe climate or weather emergencies with a policy recommendation that they could adopt. And we had a working group with Linda and Echo and myself, and we presented the memo that's available to everyone. And Echo's going to kind of lead this discussion. And it does have a bit of a time component on it. So Echo, do you want to get started on that?
Yeah. So I actually wrote up some stuff, which I think Linda might be able to put up on share screen for me. Okay, so I wrote this down because my brain's a little fried today and I wanted to make sure that I didn't waste our time. This version kind of elaborates on the memo that Linda wrote. I added some stuff to it. Based on the conversations that Rich and I have had and some research that we've both done about this issue, how it's playing out nationally. So there's really kind of some policy rationale issues that I think the council may want to explore or think about. So calling these extreme weather events shelters is a little too narrow. So if we broaden it out to say that this is really extreme weather events driven by climate change, that's really kind of getting why this is even more important than it used to be. Because now we're looking at something that's long-term, it's not gonna go away. It's going to define the rest of our lives, unfortunately. And so these extreme climate-driven weather emergencies particularly affect certain at-risk populations. So seniors, low-income folks, persons experience homelessness, but not only them. Persons with disabilities, for example, diabetics, and people who are Black, Indigenous, people of color, GLBTQ. So our climate action priorities as a city intersect with our social equity and racial justice objectives and values in the city, and that intersects with the need for extreme weather-related emergency facilities that are stable, that we can count on, that are not just coming out of Joy Fate's hide. I worry about you, friend. I do. I really, truly do. You're doing just so much, and I worry about your well-being and your ability to carry on doing the work that you're doing.
I truly, honestly and truly, when I've had enough, I will be the first to let everybody know. But until then, I'm good.
So I want you to know this is coming from a place of total respect and care.
Yeah. Thank you.
So the other piece here with the rationale is the Biden administration is putting some more emphasis on this issue. So there's a quote here from an Associated Press article that was that Rich found that was in the Oregonian a week ago. So a couple of excerpts from that article. Recognizing that extreme heat is going to be an issue, that there's a public health concern here. The Biden administration is calling for expanding its low-income home energy assistance program The county gets some of that money, and I'm not exactly sure how that works. I guess Rich told me it's going through to Access at this point rather than to the city directly. And so whether or not the county is having conversations about this change in federal policy and how that might affect not only winter shelters, but heat shelters and smoke shelters, I don't know. Linda Reed is going to be the person who will know that whenever it happens, because Linda knows everything. And then the third thing kind of goes to what I was just saying to Joy. The city's been relying on volunteers and nonprofit and religious organizations. So basically volunteers and in-kind donations. But as this happens every single summer, and it affects homeless folks and a bunch of other segments of the community, the city, starting with the council, I think has an enhanced and increased need to address these issues. So how do we do that? So the memo that Linda sent out kind of summarized the meeting that Rich and I had and some other, and we've had some additional conversations. And there's a City of Medford plan in place, and it's kind of a good starting point for the nuts and bolts, the nitty gritty. So here's some sort of putting those two things together, the content of our conversation, and then looking a little bit at the Medford document. So one of the things that we need to do, what our strategies need to do, is to set some parameters about where the need for shelter kicks in, whether it's cold, hot, or smoke. So for example, if we're looking at bad air, which has been on all of our brains, over 150 is unhealthy for everybody. Over 100 is unhealthy for sensitive groups. If you look at, Linda, can you sort of move that up a little bit for me? Thank you. If you look at the data on the Ashland Fire Department website, you can see how many days we had since the beginning of August to the present that were either unhealthy for everybody or just unhealthy for sensitive groups. Unhealthy for everybody was 11 days, and unhealthy for people in sensitive groups, if you add that in, that was 28 days, in other words, a full month.
Yeah.
And so for folks with lung conditions, heart conditions, and people living outside, that's particularly hazardous. Now, some of those bad air days also corresponded to high heat days, but not all of them. And it's not impossible that we would have bad air quality days when it's really cold, too. Although usually that bad air is from sort of a different source. It's usually not from wildfires, but it still happens. So figuring out what those triggers are is tricky. And there's some data. So this is the next bullet point here. Is that there are some organizations that explore what those thresholds are. So there's an organization that I found pretty helpful. They had a good website with a lot of info on it called the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council. There were lots of rabbit holes for me to go down. Different localities have their thresholds and trigger points set differently. But for dealing with heat stress, for example, the threshold for triggering cooling shelters is something between 95 and about 102 degrees, depending upon humidity levels.
Here in Ashland, my understanding is it is 102.
Yeah. And because we have low humidity. And then the other trigger point is how high does the nighttime low remain? And so there's some complex formulas out there that involve fancy math. So that's something that we'd probably want to explore a little bit in more detail. We know that there needs to be a coordinator, a coordinating agency. I put my extra sort of comments in italics, by the way, on this document. So we need to have good coordination, good communication, good collaboration to make these processes work. There needs to be a plan for calling, staffing, identifying, activating, setting up shelters. The City of Medford strategy has some pretty good nuts and bolts for how to do that. Really important is to have pre-approved locations. And that means that we've got to have organizations that will commit to having pre-approved locations so that Joy is not scrambling around trying to find someplace. That's not going to get the job done in the future, because this is going to happen every year for weeks at a time. So that means stakeholder groups. That means they're going to be asked to step up. We'll see how that goes. So we've got some idea of how Medford does it, and this, whatever stakeholder meetings we can get going, maybe that's a starting point for those conversations.
I would like to add, if I could just interrupt mm-hmm. 1 second, Echo. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I do have a couple of issues with the way that the Medford plan is written.
I understand.
You know, and I'm not going to like nitpick, but I know that they won't allow pets.
Right. And so you'll see down here at where the bullet points are. Okay. Yeah, I am aware of that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Good.
Yeah, I knew that.
Okay. Right.
Let's see. So we're going to need some kind of multi-agency, multi-locality shelter team. That means getting localities, jurisdictions to talk to each other. In terms of the City of Ashland itself, the primary role should be coordination. And that's probably going to fall within the scope of duties of the city manager, is our best guess. I don't know if the new city manager realizes that we're talking about him. We are. And I keep butchering his last name for some reason. I'll get better at it eventually. Let's see. I need to write it 50 times on a chalkboard, and then it'll be in my head. Whenever we activate warming shelters, cooling shelters, smoke shelters, the folks who are operating them need to obviously do some debriefing after action review, reflecting on implementation and effectiveness. I added a few things that came up when I was looking at other cities' processes. Transportation to shelter sites is necessary because not everybody has the ability to walk or have a vehicle or have a functioning bicycle, or there's ice on the street or whatever. These shelter sites have to have provisions for companion animals. And they need to be low barrier, easily accessible to persons with disabilities. And they need to be spaces that feel safe and welcoming.
Yeah.
Not like jail.
Right.
Exactly. Which I know has been a problem in Medford. So what you see at the bottom part of this document is the Medford Incident Response Guide. It sounds like it's military, which freaks me out. But, you know, it's logical, and I get that. I also put in a link to the Washington, D.C. model. Now, they're a huge city, and they've got way more facilities to draw on, obviously, than we do. But what they model for us is how to use a variety of existing facilities to provide cooling, warming, and smoke shelter. So what, if you look at their plan for 2021, you'll see that it does what the Biden administration policies are suggesting, which is to use schools and libraries and, well, we don't have a swimming pool, but if we did, or splash pads, all of that, of course, got disrupted for us last summer because of COVID. So buildings that we might have used for heat relief, for example, ended up not being viable because of COVID concerns. So we just have experienced a perfect storm of pandemic and climate-driven emergency weather needs. So I'm not going to walk through this whole Medford response guide. You can kind of just sort of read that if Linda kind of scrolls through it semi-slowly. I would define the mission as let's try to keep people alive. And then the objectives of how to do that are what follows. And then it gets very, very detailed. Linda, if you stop right there where you are, It says, consider declaring a severe weather event based on AR 708, which Linda's going to explain someday. They don't trigger the warming shelter until it's 25 degrees or less. That's way too cold. If you look at the medical criteria, the public health criteria, where cold becomes a risk factor for people, that's way too cold.
Yes.
And with heat, we can probably get away with 102 low humidity daytime if the low temperature at night is cooling down below 70 down into the 60s. If it's not cooling down at night and staying at 102 degrees during the day, then we have a problem for heat stress. This is just medical stuff. So it's really about making a case for doing this based on public health and medical criteria, not on what's bureaucratically expedient, although often that ends up being all we can do, which is better than nothing. But my perfectionist side would like to see us able to do what we should do medically for people rather than simply what we can merely afford to do. That's always going to be a challenge, and I know that. The air quality trigger, is that, should that be 100? Should it be 150? Again, I'd like to see it be 100, but maybe 150 is what's doable. There's a whole bunch of details in their plan about who calls whom first and who does the authorization. And I kind of develop brain fog when I look at this at this point.
Let's see if we can open up for questions.
Sure.
And let me just say that one of the things in any program that Medford does have is that any temperature above 80 degrees or on the low side too, it allows the city manager, the person, to go ahead and call it. So it isn't like the trigger is the absolute. It allows people to use common sense to make decisions in between when there are either smoke days or heat days or days warmer than 25 degrees, they can still go ahead and call it. So that's what we want in ours too, that ability to have that flexibility.
And I hope our city manager realizes what we're proposing, that he has that discretion.
Right. So let's see if there are some questions and then we can figure out what our next step might be on this. Chris.
I think this is probably more of a concern than it is a question. One of my concerns is, of course, location, location, location. We're talking about something that needs to be permanent and needs to be offered year round, I'm assuming. So that's that one piece. And then, of course, having it more centralized, but maybe we're also having some social services also navigate and be a part of that security. You know, you mentioned a few already, but I think that's one of my biggest concerns is, okay, this is a great, but where are we going to put this at?
Well, I'll just say in the presentation that we're going to, or the suggestions towards the city is that we proceed as, like Medford and other places, is that we call together the stakeholders in the city, the churches, the people that are providing like Joy and others. I mean, there's a lot of stakeholders in this. And if the city is calling that together, there ought to be some pressure for them to be part of a decision making. So that's where the pre-approved centers are necessary, that you have a group of stakeholders that say, yeah, we can do this when the time comes and are ready to go. And then the city then is the coordinator for those as any event is decided upon. Linda.
Just to speak to Echo's question, AR 708 is the administrative rule that was passed by the city of Medford. I feel like I meant to include it in your packet. So if I did not, I'm sorry, and I will email it out. And it essentially sets forth the criteria for how they approve those, pre-approve those sites based on building code and some fire regulations. And so the building official and the fire official come through the buildings and then they pre-approve those and then those locations become that piece. There's other parts to it as well. And to clarify too, that process is something that doesn't exist within our city, that we pass administrative rules sort of just in-house rather than going through a process like a resolution or an ordinance approval. And so our process may look different than the process the city of Medford went through.
There we go. I think the question that we need to look at in the next few minutes is what exactly is the information that we provide to the council now? The mayor was looking for something at the end of this meeting. Not that they're going to act on it that fast, but it's an update about where we are. And we looked at was that like almost a 5-page document? And I guess my suggestion is that the council won't look at 5 pages. They look at 1 page. And can we agree on kind of combining echoes and the memo that Linda put out to try to get them to have something that they'll read and kind of understand of where we're at. And then just a second, Jackie. And then The second part would be that people can join our work group if they would like, but that the work group convene a meeting of stakeholders in the, you know, within a month or so of groups that say, let's be part of the planning. And then they come up with the final set of recommendations. Because as we've seen, there's still some looseness in exactly what we want. So.
Excellent point, Reg.
Are people in agreement? And Linda Reed, are you all right with kind of putting that part together, kind of combining Echo's work in with the original piece that you had? Okay. So let me ask the other question. Are there any others, particularly of the new counselors, that would like to join that work group? It just means that you have a meeting. I saw Joy down there before we get to the next council meeting. Okay, great.
Jackie had a question.
Jackie, right.
Oh, I have lots of questions.
Okay.
This takes me back to the time when I was working, trying to find shelter locations because we had the shelter moving from church to church. And we've come a long way, and it's such a success in our city for the 24/7 shelter. And so a couple of things, and one that's kind of uncomfortable, but so I want to ask this question or point it out. Council is going to be looking at what's the cost. It's so easy to say, oh, we need transportation to get people, you know, to the emergency weather shelter, but there's costs involved to all those things. So that there needs to be thought about that. I completely support the stakeholder groups getting together. I think that's fantastic. I have always felt that the schools should be a part of our stakeholders. And we were not able to bring them to the table with looking at ongoing shelters during the cold season. But, you know, when you talk about families who are with their local school, and now we've got these remodeled schools that are going to have wonderful resource rooms and gymnasiums and all kinds of spaces that could be you know, given over to their families who are going to be suffering and having some of these issues. I just hope that we can get them. And of course, I'm talking, you know, not with COVID going on. The one thing, other thing I'd like to understand is, Linda Reed, I know you have been able to find money to do different things. I want to understand how it's working now. Are we able to pay, for instance, Joy for her, at least her supervision time, her hourly time that she's, but I'm saying, is there some money that's going from a city fund to help with what we're doing now?
You're such a good question, Jackie. So, okay, here is the nutshell that I am aware of, because this was not always within my purview. And in fact, lots of it has been under the fire department, is what I would say. There are pieces that are under the fire department, such as the smoke shelters have always been called by CERT. And apparently there was a whole structure with a multi city task force that included Shakespeare, the Chamber, SOU, who all got together and talked about spaces that were available to be used when CERT needed a space. That was all news to me, because I was not at all privy to those discussions when that took place. And I had no idea that the CERT coordinator was doing any of that prior to someone, I think, in administration asking me if I could just do it. So that was all very interesting, and I think it would be useful in the future. The other piece of that is that probably, 2 years ago, when Kelly Matting was here, she had contracted with Southern Oregon Jobs for Justice to run the emergency cold weather shelter, which is the only resolution that we have in place. Although I should note that the cold weather shelter does also have a caveat that says the city administrator can call a shelter at any time when there is inclement weather. So, if it's too hot, if it's too, smoky, the city administrator can decide at this point in time, or in this case, now the city manager, to call a shelter if there are extreme conditions. So when Kelly Matting was here, she had contracted with Southern Oregon Jobs with Justice and then asked me to work with them to make sure that when there were shelters called, that we got the word out. So my role was primarily to let 211 know when and where the shelter would be open and how people could access it, and then to put up flyers around town, and then to post it information on the city's website. So that was what I did. Kelly took, I think, and this, don't quote me on this, I want to say $100,000 from somewhere. I don't know where. It was not under a fund that I had any administrative responsibilities for, and paid them. So, and that may not even be the total amount. So bear with me on that. The following year, when Adam was in charge, he knew that Kelly had been working with Southern Oregon Jobs for Justice. And so when the weather started to turn, he asked me to reach out to them to see if they would, again, organize these shelters. And it was at that time that it was just after the Alameda fire, and they were, you know, had their own circumstances and just said, we cannot do this. And then they gave me Joy's phone number. So I reached out to Joy, and Joy and I worked together to honestly, like, hobble something together on the first horribly, like, literally bitterly cold weekend that we had.
Yeah.
And that was, Joy and Vanessa and myself, like, texting back and forth, trying to find, people to talk to. And it was, I want to say it was like Saturday or something. And we were trying to open on a Sunday. It was like late Friday, early Saturday. And at the time, we were under an emergency declaration. And so Adam had said, because we have this emergency declaration, he had the discretion to allocate city funding. And the only like unregulated discretionary city funding we had was the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. And so he authorized me to utilize that funding to pay for space and refreshments if Well, he didn't say refreshments at first, and so I did not spend money on refreshments or any sanitary products. So we got, I reached out to the homeless task force and a bunch of other people, and I just said, we need masks and hand sanitizer and gloves and whatever you can give us. And luckily they gave us up, and I still have lots of it sitting in my QB and in my garage today. So we need it. It's there for a while. So then as time went on, I could only pay for locations and refreshments when the city administrator deemed that the city could open a shelter, which of course we're not opening the shelter. We're not staffing the shelter. All we're doing is providing some funding. And so that, so we have had the discretion to spend affordable housing trust funds on shelter purposes for Joy when the city administrator deemed it an extreme weather event. And that is a total of $1,060 today.
What I'm concerned about is the supervision of these shelters, in my mind, is the most key aspect. Of course, location. But you can have lots of locations unless you have qualified supervision. And I believe that needs to be paid from some funding source. So are you saying right now Joy is not being funded for her supervision at all? See, that is that's the first issue. We need to find a way.
And never has been. So of all the things I could pay for, that is not one of them.
Yep.
But I would say that in the past, somehow, somewhere, somehow and out of some other fund that I do not know what it is, they were able to just provide a grant that then could be used for whatever that organization deemed necessary. I don't know where that money came from, though.
Okay. Gina, go ahead.
Thank you, Rich. And thank you, Linda, for that information. What I will do is I will definitely go back to council and to our city manager, Gary Milliman.
I'll get better.
I know. I have faith in you. I'm going to go back and I'm going to ask him, where did that money come from that Kelly Manning found? Where did that money come from? And I'm going to ask him about grants and how can we do this? Because he knows the importance. You know, we are aware of it. And so when we don't have the money, we don't have a location, and we don't have the money to pay for supplies, and you have these supplies, Linda, I'd love to see them out of your QB at where Joy is and our other stakeholders. So if I heard this right, I just want to recap really quick. So thank you so much, Linda and Echo and Rich, for doing this, because bringing in the stakeholders, that's our nonprofits, our churches, our maybe even bringing in the schools. Jackie, I know the schools are being redone, but looking at a forever input perpetuity. So bringing in all these stakeholders now and saying, this is where we are and this is where we need to go. Hearing that.
Right. Jackie, go ahead.
So I just want to reiterate, though, that it's great to have stakeholders. It's great to have volunteers and churches and all of those things. But you need to have a key person who is not Linda Reed, who is not a city personnel. It's somebody like a Joy Fate, who is the coordinator of the emergency weather shelter. And that person is paid to then contact who is the volunteer, where's the shelter site, how do we get the food, all there. But there needs to be a funding source, in my opinion, I feel very strongly about this, obviously, for that one supervisor who is underneath Linda Reed. Linda Reed contacts them, and then they activate and go out there and make it happen.
Yeah.
Jackie, I'll send you an email for when we meet. And so, so you can add all these things in. There's a whole lot of answers to just what you said that are being considered from other organizations. And so it's not like we haven't thought of them, but we also, I just got to say, as we go forward, you have to think of essentially the political considerations and build the kind of community support for whatever direction that we have. And so we have to be careful. For example, you could set a threshold in which 3/4 of the day of the year are going to be needed. That has a huge monetary and kind of human cost to it that we may not be able to do. So there is a balancing of how we can be ethically and morally and political policy all together. And that's what we've got to kind of come up with. Echo.
So the political consideration is something that I put at the top of what I wrote up. This is a climate change issue. This is a climate action issue. This is a social equity and racial justice issue.
Humanity.
It is also a housing issue. It is also an issue around providing services to homeless folks. But it's not just for homeless people. And I think there's been a perception in the community that the winter shelter or a cooling shelter is just for homeless people. That's wrong.
It is wrong. I have had people come that are senior citizens when I was opening it as a cooling shelter, and they would toddle in with their little dogs and, you know.
Right.
So, the other piece is long-term in Ashland. There's no place to walk inside in the summer. I was searching and searching all summer. SOU gym is unavailable to the general public.
Libraries have been open, and they've been open to homeless people when they're open.
When they're open,
In other communities, they've expanded their hours. And so the libraries are a stakeholder in this too, because that can be an easy place during many hours in which people can go and just sit and read books, and they're happy with that.
And the Jackson County Library System has hired a social worker. And I don't know if he's been on board for several months now.
Right. Lee Madsen I've talked with him at the Ashland Library about this. Okay. And he says that he doesn't have the power to change anything. He works with people and all that. But if we want something, we're going to have to get the library board and administration.
Yeah, well, they actually have a person who's their official, not Lee. It's their actual social worker, whose name I don't remember.
Well, Lee is a social worker.
No, he's not. He's a different guy. It's a guy with an MSW.
Well,
it's whose last name is, I can't remember what it is. But it's a different job. Huh?
Is his first name Derek?
I honestly don't. I'd have to Google it. I've outsourced my memory to Google. Well, I know that they hired him because somebody else I knew applied for the job and didn't get it. So it's not Lee.
In Ashland, Lee's hired to be there every day.
But he's not too. The social worker.
Well, he's
doing security.
I think he's a community liaison. I think
the
community liaison. And then there is a separate social worker. And I have heard, I think I got an email, like a email blast.
Yeah. So that's who I'm talking about. Oh. And I think another stakeholder in addition to the libraries is RVTD for the transportation piece. Mm-hmm. Right. Because some cities use the buses as cooling shelter.
Right.
And again, all of this got, you know, totally derailed by COVID.
So
and it could get derailed by COVID for who knows how long.
Well, let me just say that you can see how easy it is to be drawn into this issue and why we need to meet outside of this meeting.
Yes.
Because we have one more very important set of presentations and decisions on the CDBG performance evaluation or review or something, CAPER. And so, Linda, can we all switch to that now and everybody get out your CAPER paper? And we'll be.
I have my bagel.
Yeah. Okay, Linda, you're on with CAPER.
Okay, thank you. And just for those new members of the commission, this is a public hearing. This public hearing is to allow citizens to make comments on the use of these funds, which are federal funds. And so within our program year, we do several things. Starting in January, we issue a request for proposals for applications to utilize this funding. So that's the sort of first step in our process. That happens in January, usually right around the first. And then in February, about 45 days later, the applications are due. I get those applications in and evaluate them and write up an evaluation and provide the applications and the staff evaluation to the commissioners, who then review the applications. And then generally at our every year in our March meeting, the commission would review the applications, have a discussion, hear presentations from the applicants, and then make a award recommendation to the council. And then their recommendation and staff recommendations go forward to the city council in April, and the council would make a final determination. And then I would draft a document that is called the Annual Action Plan for the Use of Community Development Block Grant Funds. So that's the first part. Then we have a public hearing, and the public can comment on the use of those funds. They could say, this is a terrible use, this doesn't meet our goals, blah, blah, blah. They could say whatever they want. And then we have to give that information to HUD and also take that information into consideration with our grant awards. I'm missing a part, but I'll get to that later. So that happens in April. It gets submitted to HUD. HUD approves or doesn't approve. I've never had them not approve it. And then we do contracts with the grantees starting January 1st, which is the beginning of our program year. Our program year ends on June 30th. So this document, the Consolidated Annual Performance Evaluation Report, is the summary of the end of that program year. So that's why we are looking at 2020, because 2020 has now ended, and we can look at the results of our activities that we funded for program year 2020. So one thing I have to do right off the bat is apologize that the first table is completely incorrect. So please ignore those tables. So for this year, and I'll just give you a quick summary of what happened in program year 2020. We received three applications. We received an application from Maslow Project to provide essentially a program that they have been providing for many years in Ashland, which is the school-based case management and homeless outreach program. And we received an application from Options for Helping Residents of Ashland, which was requesting funding to provide a rent and utility assistance program, which was similar to a program that we had funded for many years, offered by St. Vincent de Paul, but St. Vincent de Paul was phasing that out and so did not apply that year. And then we also received an application from We also received an application from Ashland Food Angels to do some remodel work on their facility. So we did fund all of those activities. So those activities moved forward in this program year. And on page 7 is the summary of the results of those programs. So in 2020, Maslow Project served 249 homeless and at-risk youth and their families with a variety of services ranging from resource referrals to ongoing case management and temporary emergency housing. Options for Helping Residents of Ashland, we don't have any reporting results on that, and I will talk about that in a little bit, so we're going to skip over that one. And then the Ashland Food Angels program did do the repairs to their facility. And the caveat with this is that they don't actually, they don't report on the number of people that they serve, because the nature of their program is to provide resources to a variety of organizations that then serve populations. So their default is to utilize the reporting information from the Ashland Food Bank, which is the place that they provide the majority of their food. But they do also provide food to several other organizations, which just because those organizations are not also doing reporting, we don't take that reporting. So their best guess is that it's about 1,000, although at this point their program is not, or their activity hasn't been completed. So their final reporting numbers are not in. And they will do final reporting numbers at the end of their grant when they expend their final grant amount. The other thing I should say about all of our programs is that HUD requires that we take a lot of information. HUD wants to know what the ethnicity and the racial makeup of the population that you're serving is. And the reason for that is that you should not be serving disproportionately serving a population, or I'm saying it backwards. You should not be ignoring a population disproportionately. So if you have a population that has a large minority population, but everyone you're serving is white, HUD would say, why are you omitting, you know, these minority populations? That obviously is not the case here in Ashland. But the other piece about that is that HUD requires that we take income data from the populations that we serve, and that they fall into three categories: extremely low income, low income, and moderate income. Those are the only income categories that are eligible for CDBG activities, maxing out at 80% of area median as moderate. And I could give you the breakdown: 30% is extremely low, 30 to 50 is low, and then 50 to 80 is moderate. All of the populations that we have served in this year have been homeless, and homeless is a presumed benefit population. And therefore, you do not have to take information from any of them regarding income because they are presumed benefit and they will all be counted as extremely low income. So throughout this document, the 100% of our activities are considered helping extremely low income people. The options for helping residents emergency rent and utility assistance program had quite an evolution. They thought they were going to be taking over for St. Vincent de Paul at the onset of this program, or at this program year. And then of course, the pandemic happened and they ended up getting some funding from Access to help with rent and utilities for the moratorium. And through that process, they felt like they probably wouldn't need money to do that. But the administrative overhead that came with that Access grant was very low and was certainly not commensurate with the level of need they were seeing and the level of staffing they were needing to address that need. And so they asked us to amend the activity to include paying essentially for people. And we would never have been able to do that, except that because of the pandemic, HUD gave us the best thing, the best gift that HUD has ever given us, quite frankly, the mega waiver. I love the mega waiver. So the mega waiver essentially waived all the regulatory requirements, except for environmental review, for HUD funding. And those regulatory requirements were essentially that we could only spend a limited amount of money on social service, direct service sorts of activity. So we were able to use all the money to pay for staffing. We can't normally do that. And at the time, there was a big push within the city for this fear that the moratorium would be lifted and all of these people would be, you know, evicted and put out onto the streets. And so we actually increased the amount we gave them from $13,000 to $50,000 to pay for this navigation services. So that is ongoing, and we have not, we don't have any reporting on that. In the meantime, we also got, as you'll all remember well, I'm sure, we got two additional allocations of CDBG funding, which is called CDBG-CV for coronavirus. And with that money, we funded a lot of things, including, you know, the mega waiver stuff. But it all gets counted differently for HUD as this funding is specifically related to coronavirus activities. It's a little box I have to click in my database, which then tallies everything up in a different location. So with that, we initially had provided funding for showers for Aura, And that was a whole special thing where we used the money really creatively, because that was before the mega waiver. And we funded essentially economic development for someone to come clean the trailer, because that was what we needed to get the trailer open. And that was a much shorter period. And then we renewed that grant, only we didn't pay for the cleaners anymore because the mega waiver happened. We could pay for whatever. So we provided options for helping residents with Ashland for an additional just under $20,000 to continue operating the shower trailer for an additional 7 month period, I think 3 days a week, but maybe four. And in that time, they served 397 people.
They took my job away from me. So
anyway. Oh, wow. Oh, that's right, Rich. I'm so sorry.
It's all right.
So those are essentially the highlights. With the reporting that we have, HUD has this thing, and you'll get to know this later. HUD has a database that I use to do essentially everything in. And the database spits out these reports. The reports were actually better when it wasn't put in a database, because you could put whatever you wanted in there. I used to put all kinds of fun stuff. But anyway, now I'm limited to what they want me to put in there. And I'm also limited to the format of all their crazy forms and spreadsheets. And so most of what's in here, like here's the racial and ethnic compositions. The reporting that did happen shows the breakdown of the populations from what was given to us. I should also mention that all of the reporting is generally done on a quarterly basis and would identify just those pieces that I spoke about: race, number, income level. We never get any personal information about people. I don't know their names. I don't know their social security numbers. We don't even take information about citizenship status. That's not necessary. So they're fairly anonymous to me. And then there's also some bits about how much money we got, how much money we spent. And then probably the more interesting pieces are at the very end, which are these required reports by HUD that it spits out all this interesting information, a complete breakdown of who got paid what and what type of activity it is. So anyway, is there anything that I didn't cover that you guys found confusing? Or, I should go back and say that every 5 years we have to do what is essentially our 5-year grant application for this funding. And it's a pretty giant process that is prescribed by HUD, and you all get to take a huge part in that, because there's a big community outreach and we need to get information about community needs and community resources and how we will meet them. We answer all these questions. And then we set our numeric goals for the 5-year period, which essentially says we expect to hopefully do these things, and these things. These are all hopeful because we're never the applicants, and we are beholden to the people who will come and apply to meet those needs for us. And so the trick is to make the goals broad enough that we can accommodate activities that can happen while also hopefully hitting our numeric targets. Not that we will get in trouble if we don't by HUD, but just we want to set out realistic goals. So the action plan and the CAPR both address how we are meeting those larger 5-year goals.
Linda, can I just say we're approaching our deadline?
Yes.
And I say just for the new people on the commission, this is our deepest dive into bureaucracy, but a very necessary one. But the step that we need to do is to have a motion to approve the CAPR report.
Yes. And then if there are any comments about it, if you have any corrections, I absolutely appreciate those, because I'll take corrections. If there are a lot of corrections that you've seen, please feel free to just email them to me and I will do those.
Okay, so let's just see, are there any questions that we need to get answered at this moment, or you would like to get answered? I see. Okay, and second would be...
I think Kathy has a question, Rich. Kathy?
Oh, Kathy, go ahead. Yeah.
Sure. Yes, just as a new member, so Linda, you were speaking to the importance of the 5-year goals impacting the priorities of the CAPR report. Does that dovetail with that goal setting meeting at the end of the year where you're setting priorities for the CAPR for the next year?
That's a super good question, Kathy, and it certainly can, although it doesn't have to. So your goals, your commission goals are like your own. You know, they can be outside of what HUD would prescribe, because a lot of the goals are prescribed by HUD. I mean, essentially they set out how much housing do you have? So they have a special tabulation of census data that comes out. It's called CHAZ data, and it actually looks at a breakdown of housing need by income, by type, whether it's homeownership or rental. And so we kind of have to work with what they tell us we need. So that evaluation that we do is supposed to shape the goals so that we're sort of meeting those greatest needs that we have found through that evaluation and outreach process. As we get toward the end of our 5 years, when we look back at our goals, so that table that I said is not updated, when those percentages based on the numbers, which are not in here, and I super apologize, I will fix it and send it out to you tomorrow for review. We kind of try to hit those. Like if we need 25 housing units, hopefully we're at, you know, 50%, 100%. Like I said, we're kind of beholden to the people who apply, because we're never building the housing. We're never, you know, doing the services for homeless populations. We're never, you know, rehabbing houses or providing services for special needs populations. It really is other agencies. But as you score your applications in reviewing them, you kind of look at those goals and think, if we haven't met this goal and I have an application for this goal, and we've met this goal and I have an application that also meets that goal, maybe my higher priority is to fund the project that will meet the goal we haven't met yet.
Okay, just hang on for folks. Are people able to do another 10 minutes? I see everybody's all right with that. Okay, go ahead. And Gina?
No, I'm sorry, you guys, I have to go.
Let me just, as you have to go, is there any liaison report, just quickly, you want to say?
I'll be very quick. Something that I want, this was an awesome meeting. And something that I am going to do, Linda, thank you for bringing that up. I want to go to our city manager and see where the money came from that Kelly Matting found, and to ask, are there any trust? I want to dig a little bit deeper into that, and then I'll come back to you with it. I appreciated this. And when you put the information together for council, I agree with Rich. So much reading. Jackie knows that. So if you can just stick some links in there in your report so that we can always go look at the links also. So thank you all so much for a great meeting. Welcome on board, Joy and Kathy. We're going to have a good time.
All right. So let me ask, is there any, thanks, Gina. Is there any feedback that people want to put in at this point about what we've just heard? Jackie.
So I'm happy to make a motion. Now, Linda, you said in that first chart, there were some pretty unusual percentages that were printed out there. So I'm happy to make a motion to approve the CAPR with corrections provided by any HHS commissioners who would like to contact Linda.
That's perfect, Jeff.
Can I say that any harder?
Okay, folks, so here's a good decision point for us. Is there someone that would like to second that motion? Chris.
Oh, let Chris do it.
Chris got it, yes. Okay, so it's been moved and seconded that we adopt the CAPR with those modifications that are possible. First, is there any more discussion? Okay, Jackie.
So one discussion piece is, Linda, there are times when there is money left over that we haven't allocated. And I'm wondering, in this case, is there money? I know we've paid for, you know, hard of hearing lights and devices at our stop signs and things. I'm just wondering, any money left over from this?
Glad you asked that, Jackie. So I am super excited to report that for the first time since 2013, we only have $9,000 in capital funding left. Only 9,000. Okay, but that's not the sum total of how much money we have. But capital money is the hardest money to get rid of. We struggle with it every year. We've been carrying way too much of it year over year, and it has actually gotten us in trouble with HUD. So yay! We do also have another 146,000 or so, give or take, of funding available that is left over from both CDBG-CV from our second allocation and 2020 funding and a teeny bit from 2019. Both of those, so all of that money is what I should say is subject to that mega waiver. So all of that money has essentially very few restrictions on it, which is why we've been kind of hoarding it for other uses, because it, you know, we don't want to squander it on capital, which we can only use for capital. So, and it is also CDBG-CV money. So technically the only time the mega waiver applies is when we apply it to coronavirus related activities. So we do have that money available.
Right. I'm going to call the question and ask people to vote on this, but I do want to say that we have a brilliant staff person that's been able to balance this incredibly difficult amount of money that can do great work if we have a great balancer. And so I would just say thank you for that. And with that, all those in favor of adopting the motion, wave your hands indicated. And Joy and Kathy, you can if you would like.
I would like to approve it with the amendments.
Right, with the amendments, yeah. Right. Okay. Well, anybody opposed to it? So it has passed. So we only have just a couple of things. Is there any other liaison reports that people need to mention?
Well,
okay, Jackie.
Sorry to be a pain, but going back to the money that's left over, well, we have an opportunity to discuss how that money is going to be used and understand the timeline with which we need to spend it. And one of the things that comes to my mind is, did we get air conditioners and heaters in those pallets? So we've already used that for that. Okay, those are the kinds of things I'm trying to think of for that money.
Okay.
We got the air conditioners. We paid for that out of affordable housing trust funds. I guess if I had a liaison report, the thing I would tell you is that we have 6 years to spend the coronavirus money. So we actually are not under any restraints with that, which is the other reason why we're not like pushing it out the door. We're still under an emergency declaration, which still means that there's sort of leeway in the process. Of course, January will essentially be here really, really soon. As we all know, it just goes by so fast. And we will reissue our RFP for CDBG funds applications. And so we may issue it at that time, but it would be as a separate allocation probably to say, you know, this funding has the ability to fund extra things, but must be related to coronavirus. And we have a lot of people who want that money, I should say. You know, Peace House still needs money for their meals. Aura still needs money for staff. I think Rogue Retreat is going to come in and need money for the urban shelter. We can't ever come up with the right term for that. I think there are other uses, other organizations. I think Maslow would probably be, I think there's a lot. So, you know, I think to be have a fair process, we're going to have to put it out through an RFP, but I just want to make sure that people know that money is, you know, not as restricted as the other money.
Okay. Thank you.
But I also want to tell you on my liaison report really quickly that I heard from NeighborWorks Umpqua, who has gone through quite a few changes at their office, and they have given us back the grant we gave them in 2020 for $43,500. We will not be moving forward with that activity. So we do also have a little over $100,000 in the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, which will also be offered through an RFP process next year. So $100,000 to add to whatever is in the coffers now, plus whatever we actually get back from FEMA, because we still have not gotten any reimbursements from FEMA.
Linda, how much did NeighborWorks give back?
$43,500.
Okay, thank you.
Echo?
Echo.
For the October agenda, can we get an update on what I'll call the pallet community? And for lack of a better term, and particularly how we're planning for leading into winter, which, because winter is coming, as they say in that show that I never watched. Can we get an update about what's happening with Snowberry 2?
As far as I know, Snowberry 2 is opening soon. They asked for their certificates of occupancy and should be starting to take people now. People I hear are getting letters. So that's all really positive.
I don't know that they've asked for their certificates of occupancy because they haven't had final inspections yet.
Oh, I just, who contacted me? Either April or Derek contacted me to make sure that all of their SDC paperwork was filled out because they can't get CFOs until that's done.
So I think they're working ahead because there's still 3-4 more buildings that need final.
Oh, but I think they're going to do it building by building.
Oh, well, maybe that's what they're doing then.
So, what about Columbia Care?
Oh, Liz,
is that the one behind Rogue?
Yeah.
They're building and they're getting inspections.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Can I just comment on both of those? Because I think I would like to see us ask for, in each case, some kind of grand opening publicity. Yeah. I know there's some question in Columbia Care about whether they're, I don't know, but it just seems to me that it would really help the citizens of our city to see two. And when you tell people about what's in them, they just love them and they don't know about them. And so I just think there's an opportunity for us to tie our city work as we fund them into the success that they're anticipating. So I don't know how we do that, but if
that's a great story for the newsletter for the long-term recovery group as well, for fire victims to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so happy to be working with Kathy on that other group. I'm going to enjoy spending a lot of time with you, Kathy.
Yay. Ditto.
All right. So are there any other October meeting questions? Oh, let me just say it's an announcement-y thing. One of the things that's going on in our area is a strong interest in preservation of mobile parks, really strong. And there's interest in a group of mobile park residents about looking at a mobile park ordinance like they have in Portland now. And so there's going to be, that effort is going to be really ramping up in the next few months. So not hearing any other points, I'm wondering whether we can adjourn, but let me just say to the new folks, I hope we have a culture in the commission that allows us to be both affirmative and critical of where we are. If we can do it better, we need to hear from folks. And having new folks come in with new eyes is a great privilege for us. So at the end of meetings, if we're not crowded, we would like to hear from folks about what makes it easier and better for us to do this work. So are there any comments before we go on? Oh. Thanks, everyone. It was a really terrific meeting. Maybe we can catch up with Habitat in the near future here.
I'll send an email to Denise.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you. Good
to see you. Can I just mention, if there's any way that Linda Reed could do a little onboarding with Joy and Kathy, that's a wonderful thing. Maybe it's a Zoom meeting. because I had the privilege of sitting down with Linda for several hours and having her try to pour over me all this information, you know, capers and all these different things. So I just hope Joy and Kathy can have that same kind of connection with the encyclopedia brain of Linda Reed. So,
you know, in my old job, I got an award and it was the Encyclopedia Brown Award.
Oh.
So cool. Awesome. Thanks, everybody.
Can I just ask a quick question? And that is, if anybody would like to call me or text me or what have you, you should all have my phone number or email or what have you, and just reach out anytime.
Awesome. So
Liz will send out binders and all of that information will be in the binders for
I'll update the commissioner list and send it out to the existing commissioners too.
Right.
Thank you very much. And I'll be happy to pick up my documents at your office, Linda.
Great.
Thanks, guys. Have a good
day. Nice meeting, folks.
Bye. Thank you so much.